Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack.
Welcome to Top Shelf at Merrick Library. I'm your host, Carol Ann Tack, and thanks as always for joining me. Last summer, a galley copy of We Begin at the End was sent to me by Henry Holt and Company, the book publishers. Now, it was given to me right before I went on vacation, and I'm using air quotes here, such as it was in 2020, and the timing was perfect. I knew nothing about the book, nothing about what genre it was, nothing about the story, nothing about the author. I just went in as a blank page waiting for the book to write on me, so to speak. And I remember the exact day I finished it and I wrote it down. It was August 15th, 2020. It was late at night and I sat there stunned. The very next day, I reached out to anyone who would listen to me to ask for the opportunity to interview today's guest, Chris Whitaker, for his extraordinary book, We Begin at the End. And now, just this morning, GMA, Good Morning America, announced it as a buzz pick. So, Chris Whitaker, for heaven's sake, welcome to Top Shelf at Merrick Library. I am so happy you're here. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited. That was a lovely intro as well. Thank you.
Your debut novel, Tall Oaks, won the CWA John Creasy New Blood Dagger. And I will be honest, I haven't read Tall Oaks, but I have ordered multiple copies for the library because I know once patrons start reading We Begin at the End, their journey of discovery for all things Chris Whitaker will just be starting. So I'm telling you, listeners, get ready to read this book. I will never be able to do We Begin at the End justice. So if you would, please tell listeners what this book is all about.
Okay, so it's a story that follows a 13-year-old girl named Duchess and a middle-aged police chief named Walk in the small California town that they live in. And they might sound like they don't have an awful lot in common, but they're both very much alone, both very much struggling and very much impacted by the death of a child that occurred 30 years before, so long before Duchess was born. And they're kind of living under this cloud of this event. And the people at the forefront of the event will Walk, Duchess's mother, and her mother's boyfriend, Vincent. Now, Vincent went to jail for 30 years for causing the death of this child. And we join the story a couple of days before he's due to come home. And Duchess is terrified of this happening because her mother is an addict. She's kind of the sole carer to her younger brother, Robin. And their situation is very fragile. And she knows that, you know, the slightest ripple is going to ruin them. And so she's very wary of this guy coming back into their lives. And she takes action and she does something that is understandable from her point of view, but also quite shocking. And it sets off this chain of events that shape the next year in their lives. And we follow them from that point all the way to Duchess moving to Montana, to Walk kind of struggling. He's not well, struggling to preserve the town that he's lived in. He has this vision of Vincent, the 15-year-old Vincent, and he expects that Vincent to be the Vincent that comes back from prison, which is kind of ridiculous, you know, because he expects prison not to have changed him. And yeah, and it's basically about what happens. So it's kind of a book about family and the evolving nature of that word, the evolving meaning of that word for Duchess. And it's about self-sacrifice and kind of self-loathing and just how you outrun the mistakes of your past.
And boy, do those mistakes come back. Everyone will be talking about outlaw Duchess Day Radley. Mm-hmm. Can you, I mean, she's amazing. Everyone seems to really, yeah. It resonates. She resonates with everybody. Can you tell us the inspiration for Duchess?
Yes. So the inspiration for Duchess, we have to go back. She was kind of born from the past trauma in my life. So we have to go all the way back to when I was a teenager to just after I left school with no qualifications because I got drunk the night before my economics exam, like really, really drank a lot and like teenagers do all the time. But I just happened to choose the night before my big exam and woke up in the hospital, missed the exam, left school with no qualifications and no idea where I was headed, really. Back then, I just wasn't clear about where I was going, you know, what I wanted to do. Just no idea, really. And it's such an important time, isn't it? you know, you're so young and you have to make this big decision that will kind of shape the rest of your life. And if you get it wrong, especially now, it's kind of unforgiving, isn't it? You know, for young people, you know, yes. You go out into the world and try and get a job, and it's hard to get jobs. Jobs are hard to come by. But so you've got all this pressure, and I really felt that pressure. And I thought, I'm not going to take the path expected of me. I'm not just going to go and get any old degree and then go into whatever job just so that I can work 9 till 5. And I thought, I'm going to go out, try some different things. So I kind of bounced from job to job, worked in a bakery, in supermarkets, in did loads of bar work, which I loved. And then I was working as a real estate agent, and I was out dropping leaflets through people's doors. And someone came up to me in the street, and it was a quiet street in North London, and early in the morning, no one was around, and he asked to borrow my phone, and I could tell, you know, that I was going to get mugged. You know, I knew what was coming, because I, you know, growing up in London, it's a big city, it happens all the time. I had friends that have been mugged, stuff like that. I didn't want to give it to him, and he asked for my wallet, and we kind of, there was a scuffle, and it turned into a fight, and I was holding my own. And then he pulled out a kitchen knife and stabbed me in the side a few times. And I didn't realize at first, you know, that I was being stabbed, because, you know, the adrenaline's going and you don't kind of feel the pain for a few seconds. It doesn't kick in. And then I looked down and I saw this blood, and I saw my shirt, because I was wearing a white shirt and it was all red. And I dropped the phone, dropped my wallet. He dropped the knife, actually, and then picked everything up and just ran. And I drove myself to hospital. Luckily, it wasn't that far. You know, I could almost see the hospital from the street. It was right near a hospital.
Oh, my gosh.
But yeah, it was a convenient location for a stabbing, actually. So, every cloud.
And yet here we are laughing about it, right?
Oh, my God. I know. So I drove myself to the hospital, and they stitched me back together again. And then I went home, you know, put my feet up. Everyone told me I was lucky, which, you know, I wasn't, you know, it could have been worse, could have hit, you know, a major organ, something like that. I was also, you know, just unlucky, because I was just going about my day, you know, as people are, aren't they, all the time. You get people that are trying to go about their day, and you get people that, you know, that are bad, that want to do bad things, and we collide with them. You know, it happens all the time. We see it in the news. And that's what happened to me. And then I knew nothing of PTSD. And so it was a shock to the system, you know, that I was just couldn't sleep, just lie awake all night, kind of staring at the ceiling. And it wasn't that I was even thinking about what had happened. I just couldn't function. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I couldn't drink. I couldn't. Everything felt too difficult. My reason for kind of being every day was just to make it through. If I can just survive today, then tomorrow might be better. But it didn't get better. It was just exactly the same. It was just me not recognizing me anymore. All of a sudden, someone completely different. I was very unhappy, and I could laugh, like, say my brother made a joke or we were watching a film, I could laugh at something, but it was like kind of on autopilot. You know, there was nothing behind it. It was just, oh, they're expecting me to laugh, or expecting me to say something, or expecting me to say that I'm okay. So I did that. And that only can last for so long before, you know, I turned to drink and took some drugs and things like that, because it helped a bit. It was kind of like distraction.
Well,
it
and everyone's telling you, you're so lucky, but you're not exactly feeling that way.
No. And I'm terrible at asking for help, and I'm still like that now. I never, ever ask for help from anyone. My wife is a worrier, and she's constantly asking if I'm okay or something. She can read me quite well now, so she knows if something's bothering me. But I still, I just don't ask for help. And I didn't feel able to. And I didn't want to disappoint everyone. You know, I didn't want my parents to worry about me. I didn't want to be that person that is a drain on other people. That's how I felt. Yeah, so that combination, not sleeping, of drinking too much, of taking drugs and not eating and things like that, takes a real toll. So I got to a point where I was hoarding painkillers and researching how to do it and stuff like that. And then I sat down with them all and was going to write a note to my parents, just not saying sorry, because I was of the view that I'm living this life just for you, you know, for someone else. And that's not my life. I can choose to end it if I want to, you know, if I don't want to live it anymore. But I was also aware of how difficult that would be. As a parent, there can be nothing worse than outliving your child or something like that happening. So it was a horrible time. But when I sat down to write, I'd been to the library and I got a book out, and it was a therapy book. And it was, you take what had happened, you take the traumatic incident, you write about it, and you change the things that you don't like about it, or don't, you change the characters involved, you change the outcome, you change the location, you just change it in your mind. And I was skeptical. I thought, this sounds like crap, you know, it's not going to work. But I wrote Duchess, the character in We Begin at the End. She appeared kind of on the page almost fully formed. I just wrote this victim, you know, someone that was outwardly small and vulnerable, and she had worn clothes, and she, her name, you know, made her a victim. And I started writing her, and I don't know if it snapped me out of it that night or it just gave me something else to do for a few hours. But then I was tired and I went to bed and slept for about 6 hours, which hadn't happened since the incident.
Wow.
And I thought, something has clicked here, something works. So the more I wrote, the better I felt. And probably a year of just writing bits of Duchess's life, just random scenes. Like, there's a bar scene in the book where she and someone, her mum's playing guitar on stage, and people are heckling her, and Duchess loses her cool and breaks a bottle and holds it to someone's throat, and she's this little girl doing this, you know. And but I saw these scenes so vividly, and I put all my effort, all my concentration went into writing these scenes as perfectly as I could. Like, I was there, like I could see everything that she could see. And so distraction might have been part of it, why it helped. So that's how Duchess was born. But then probably a year later, I was kind of well enough to start thinking about what am I going to do now? My friends were well on their way, you know, at university, studying to be doctors, lawyers, things like that. They had lives, and I was kind of just stuck. And then I picked up a newspaper and saw an article about a stockbroker. And there was a picture of this guy, and he had a Ferrari, red Ferrari. And I love Ferraris, you know, since I was a kid. You know, I used to have toy Ferraris, and I thought, God, this is the life for me. This is what I want. And I gave no real thought to it. You know, I didn't know what a stock was. I didn't know anything about it. And I'm not good at maths. I'm really not good.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So, but I thought, you know, I'm going to be a stockbroker. And I printed my CV, which had nothing on it. You know, it had a few bar jobs and things like that. And it was kind of laughable. And I went, got the train into London, went into the city, started kind of knocking on doors. And I think I found someone that took pity on me. they gave me a job, and I kind of moved around a bit, moved to different companies. And then I worked my way up and became, I wanted to work on a trading desk, a proprietary trading desk, which is where you take the money that the company's made and you reinvest it. So you have no clients. You're right at the kind of front end.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And my boss said to me, if you lose $20,000, you stop trading. We talk about what went wrong. That is your stop loss. That's your limit. Don't break it. And then the next day I lost $2 million. And that was a shock to the system. And my friend...
to yours and theirs, I would
say. Yeah. Well, they didn't know, because my friend worked in the back office. And I said to him, let's keep it quiet.
Oh, boy.
Let me make it back, which I couldn't. It's madness. You know, I wasn't going to make it back. So I lost a bit more for good measure. I was kind of making money. I was getting the hang of it, but I had this whopping great loss hanging over me. And I knew it was going to come crashing down, and it did. And because I walked into the office one day and everyone was waiting for me in the boardroom, lawyers and bosses and people, you know, compliance. And they sat me down and said, you know, everything came out. They knew about it. So they sat me down and said, if you agree to pay back half of it, then we will let you carry on trading with us. We won't go to the police, which was good of them, because they could have, you know, they kind of, yeah, they gave me a break. They really did. And again, I was lucky without feeling like I was lucky, because I went home at 24 years old with $1 million worth of debt.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I'd signed something. So that was my debt that belonged to me.
Now, while this is happening, you still have Duchess in the back pocket somewhere.
I do. Yeah. But I put her down for a good few years. I put her down and forgot about her, and because I felt like I was okay. Like, I didn't need to write. You know, I didn't want to be a writer. I didn't give any thought to that sort of thing. I wasn't academic in any way. I wasn't, writing is something for clever people, you know, and artistic people. And so I went home. I was engaged, apparently successful. You know, that was the perception. You know, he's doing really well. I watched my, it's funny, actually, that going off slightly, but I watched my wedding video not that long ago. And in one of the speeches, my brother, my best man, talks about money. And he talks about, oh, Chris is doing well. Chris is, you know, and he keeps it. And it's, yeah, and I'm looking at myself during that speech, and I can see it in my eyes, this kind of house of cards that I've built that's about to fall down. So the wedding cost spiraled. My wife thought I was doing well. We went on a fancy honeymoon, which I put on my credit card. And I know. Yeah. So it was like the
Christ,
perfect
you're storm. Killing me.
Yeah. So I became a city cliche, you know, of a drug taking cocaine, that sort of exactly as you imagine. And yeah, lost it again. You know, everything I'd built back up was just gone. And I was right back where I had come from. Was that boy again, you know, that kid that had just been stabbed. I was right there again. And it was back to Duchess. It was looking at churches with my wife in the day and looking at life insurance policies in the evening. That's where I was. And then Duchess saved me for the second time, you know, writing that girl, writing this book and just writing in general, without doubt, saved my life twice now. And then I kept at it this time. I worked off that debt for years and paid it off, got myself out of trouble. And that was largely thanks to writing, probably every night, you know, at least an hour a night, just writing bits and pieces, scenes that didn't run together. And then I got nearer to my 30th birthday and I started to feel it again a little bit, that kind of pull to start taking drugs again. And I was drinking a lot again, and it doesn't really leave you. And I thought, there's no reason this time. What's going on? I'm not in loads of debt anymore. I've not just been attacked. You know, what is going on? And I put it down to, if writing was the thing that saved me, writing is the thing I should be doing. And I read a book called The Last Child by John Hart. And did a thing with John Hart that you saw the other day that I was like so special to me. And then I read an interview with John Hart, and he talked about how he gave up a career as a lawyer to write, basically, to do something that made him happy. And I was called into my boss's office and offered a promotion. And right there and then, this was about a week after I'd read that interview, I just quit my job. I said, I don't want to do it anymore. Walked out. My wife was pregnant. I hadn't told her that I was quitting my job till I got home. Yeah, she was pregnant. She was a student at the time. We had no other income. So I'd done something big. This was a big thing to do at 30. You know, you should be well on your way to what you're going to do. I'd laid the groundwork for a career in finance.
Well, that's in theory, right? I mean, that's what everybody says you should be doing. And boy, Mrs. W needs a big, big hug from everybody.
She does, and she did at the time. But we sat up that night till the early hours, kind of talking through our options. And we decided by the time the sun came up, she had a plan for us. Sold our flat, sold our car, moved to Spain, because we had no real overheads or anything like that. So let's just go and live in Spain. Cost of living is less. And, you know, it's in the sun. It's by the beach. We needed a break, I think. We'd kind of been stuck. And she knew I wasn't happy. And I think that's why it was, as much as it was a shock, it was also, she could breathe out and you know, this is what's wrong with you. This is what's been bothering you. So we moved to Spain and I got to work writing. And I didn't write Duchess. You know, I didn't want to write that. That didn't feel like a book that I wanted to write. It felt like that was too personal. That was something for me. So I wrote Tall Oaks, my debut. And then we lived there for a year or so while I wrote this very rough first draft. And we moved back to London and the baby came, and you know, life got in the way for while I was submitting to agents, because I didn't know, you know, I didn't know the mechanics of it, a publishing deal. I didn't know that you needed an agent. I didn't know how competitive it was. I didn't know that agents get hundreds of manuscripts every year and they take on a handful of new writers. But I do believe that, you know, you put the hard work in, sometimes you're rewarded, but there is some luck. There is some, it needs to land on the right desk at the right time. And it did, thankfully. And I had quite a few agent offers. Like, I went into London and met with six different agents and eventually and chose, you know, one was my clear favourite that I really wanted from the beginning. Her name's Kath Summerhays, and she did work at WME, and she now works at Curtis Brown, an amazing agency, and I'm still with her now. And then Tall Oaks got nominated for an award, went to a big award ceremony. People probably listening to this won't be able to see this, will they? But you can see it behind me.
I can. It's there. Amazing. It's beautiful.
So Tall Oaks won. Tall Oaks won this award. Like, it's the equivalent of your Edgar's.
Yes.
So it's a dagger in the UK. And and we got back to the hotel and Victoria, my wife, just burst into tears. Oh. And it was, it was like at that point, I think I realised how much she had been through with me, you know, and it had taken a toll, but it felt, like we'd found something.
Well, it's the validation of all of your hard work and her support and love. And I mean, that's a partnership.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a nice moment. And it was, again, you know, I thought they'd made a mistake because I didn't write, because I was up against all these massive authors. I didn't write a speech because I thought, we'll just go. It's a free meal, you know, in a fancy hotel. Let's just go. And
so
and
now I want to know what you said.
I forgot to thank everyone. I remembered to thank her, but I forgot to thank virtually everyone else. So I made a mess of it, but I didn't care at the time. You know, I took the award and ran in case they had made a mistake. You know, this is mine. You're not getting it back.
And you ran out the back door in case they changed their mind.
Yeah, never to be seen again.
He's somewhere in Spain. It was the last time we saw him.
Carrying a dagger. Yeah.
This very shiny thing. We don't know what it was. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so that is the very long answer to your very simple question. Where did Dutchess come from?
There couldn't be another answer to that. So you write Tall Oaks. And then you write a second book, which is very hard to get in the United States, I presume, by tomorrow morning. That will all be different and everyone will be clamoring to get the second book, which is
All the Wicked Girls.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, once everyone does the deep dive on this book, then we're going to need to get all the other ones in. So, you know, maybe we'll help you get on your way to that Ferrari. Mm-hmm. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, oh yeah, I've forgotten about the Ferrari. I really want the Ferrari, but I'm too careful now. I'm so careful with money. Yeah. No Ferraris, just savings, sensible savings.
I'd like to see your interviews with your accountants going forward.
I know. Yeah. I love my accountant.
That would be something else for sure, because now you
know. He earns his money, my accountant. Let's put it that way.
Well, you have so much knowledge now, so you can sort of, hysterical. So you write the second book, and then when do you make the commitment to Dutchess?
So I had a two-book deal for Tall Oaks and All the Wicked Girls, and I came to the end of that, and I gave some thought to, do I want to write another crime book? You know, I'd built a bit of a following. I'd won the award, but I had this kind of feeling there was unfinished business. I knew it was going to be hard, but it was also kind of there. You know, every time I opened my computer screen, you know, every time I looked at the screen, I could see it there, this file that just said Dutchess. And I thought, I either go for it now or I never do it, because I knew it was going to take years. You know, and publishers like ideally would like you to write a book a year. That's how you build a fan base. That's how you, every summer your new book comes out. But it was a good chance to do it, to see if I could do it. I knew it would be hard, but I didn't think it would be as hard as it was. It was probably about 4 years of very, very difficult. You know, looking back, 4 years of a difficult time coming back all of a sudden into my life, a time that I'd done a lot of work to leave it behind, to leave that version of myself behind. And I worried that it would kind of pull me back into it. And my wife was a bit worried about it. And it didn't, I didn't know if it was worth it, if it would be worth it, if I would even get to finish it, if I would. Holding the finished copy now feels like it's, I've run a marathon. I managed to get to the end of it. Yeah, but so I really struggled with the writing of it for years. And then I have the best editor in the world in Amy Einhorn. She is just so incredibly talented. And
all hail. All
right. Yeah, all hail. Yeah, that's right. And she helped me finish the book. And she saw something in it that I even didn't see. And she saw, you know, she's a very good reader of the characters and me and the kind of book that I wanted it to be. And we got there. And I'm really glad that we did. Because Good Morning America, I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
As I said this morning, I'm, you know, brushing my teeth and all of a sudden there's your face in the middle of Times Square.
Isn't it ridiculous?
And I'm pointing at the TV going, I'm interviewing him in like an hour.
I know. And I showed that video to my kids and they were very disinterested. It's like, daddy's a big deal and they don't care.
If you said that's where the ball drops every year in the United States.
Yeah.
That might have worked. Yeah.
No, they want to. So I read them a bedtime story every night. They're only small and they're desperate for me to read them something that I've written. But it's just not going to happen for many years. And I think about it as well. I think about them seeing things like this that we're doing, hearing things like the podcast and reading The Guardian. And I worry about it. I really do. I think, you know, that they might see me differently or something is something I worry about.
Well, you think about your parents a certain way, and then as you get older, you become more informed, and hopefully with the maturity. I mean, I look at my parents a certain way now that I did when, you know, they were like Wonder Woman and Batman, you know, when I was a kid, like they could do no wrong. And of course, it gradually changes when you realize the humanity. But I think that there's a lot to be said for the road that it took to get you to where we are today. And there's so much to admire you for. So I'm sure they will get there. I'm sure.
I think, And I always think, you know, every one of us has a million things that they would do differently if they had their time again, but we wouldn't be the people we are now.
Right. You know, there's a different multiverse version of us that are out there.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't 2020, everything that happened, you'd be standing in the middle of Times Square, and it would be a whole different thing. So having said everything that you just said, you start out with Duchess. Mm-hmm. And as you're starting out with Duchess, when do the other people, the other characters, when does Walker start showing up? When does Star start showing up? How early are these characters showing up for you?
Before I started writing the book. You know, before I properly started writing it, I gave Duchess a mother that she had to look after and a brother that she had to look after. And I projected a lot onto that character. You know, if I was angry, Duchess is filled with rage. You know, she is angry. If she's tough because I wanted to be tough. Yeah, she's everything I went through. In Star, I gave her a very difficult mother. Star loves her kids, but she battles with drugs. I can relate. She is struggling to outrun something that happened to her that was terrible. And I can relate to that as well. And in Walk is, I love Walk. He's so good. He's innately good. You know, I choose to see everyone that I meet as innately good. I think everyone is good. And we're all more than the bad things that we do. And we're all complex. But Walk is Duchess's moral compass. You know, she won't admit it, but they have kind of this beautiful friendship that unfolds over the course of the book. And I enjoyed writing Walk, you know.
And their relationship between Walk and Duchess, what a relationship that you have given them. I mean, that is a gift for the readers. And with everything that happens, I mean, he is just an amazing character. And I think of all of the characters, there are so many people in this book, but you don't forget a single name. Like sometimes readers will say, oh, well, there were so many characters. I know who Hal is. I know who Vincent is. I certainly know who Dickie is. And just to leap off of Dickie, I found out this week that Disney is doing something magical with We Begin at the End. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
I can. Yeah, I love talking about this, actually, because it's all brand new. So, yeah, I had this crazy few weeks where I was working in the library in the day and then going home and having Zoom meetings with the big Hollywood studios. You know, all the big guns came out, and it was it was surreal, and it was lovely. And I got to listen to people that I'm such a big fan of talk about the book, talk about Duchess, and talk about how they're a fan of the characters. And Disney was so good. Tommy and Jennifer. So Tommy is my kind of main point man and has helped make this happen. And he is the director of Hamilton, which I thought was just brilliant. You know, Hamilton is a masterpiece, you know.
Masterpiece, exactly.
Yeah. And just talking to him about the book, he really got the characters and he really got what I was trying to do. And I thought, this is such an easy decision, you know, because I was agonizing over it because it felt like a big decision. You know, I don't want to get this wrong. It's my characters. I want people that want it, not because they think it's going to sell really well, the book. I want people that want it because they like the book, you know, they like the story and they don't want it because other people want it, which I know can be naive because I'm aware of how business works and you need to drive up that demand and things like that. But it was so important to me that they wanted it because they believed in it. And without doubt they do. And yeah, it's been just wonderful.
And to be as true, to have that devotion and to have that drive to be as true to your characters as possible is what I'm hearing you're saying about Disney.
Yeah. And it's, I know how it works, you know, just because it works in a book, you know, and on the page, it doesn't translate instantly. You know, there will be changes. There has to be. Wouldn't have it any other way. but they do seem to want to be faithful to the original whilst making it their own. And that works for me. And it's Disney, you know.
Yeah. And think about it from the fan's perspective, from the reader's perspective, you know, every time something fabulous happens to this book, it's almost like the reader says, oh, I knew it. It validates us because we all are having a shared experience with We Begin at the End. We all are doing this.
I think if anyone can do it, I think they can do it. I think they're just so talented. You know, they are a really talented bunch of people. And
even recently, News of the World just got the movie treatment, and News of the World by Paulette Giles, everyone was really worried how that was going to work out. And then next thing you know, Tom Hanks is cast, and it's just a beautiful movie, and they did a great job. So I feel like the same thing is going to happen here. The location, and I do wonder where they're going to set the movie, because the book is set in these fictitious towns, Cape Haven, California, Copper Falls, Montana. Throughout the book, there's so much character development, but the book is also a study of small town America. And honest to God, I don't know how you did that. Why these two locations? And have you ever been to either place? Have you been to that northern coast of California or to Montana?
I haven't been to either, but it sounds kind of crazy and was a crazy decision, because I spent years and years researching, and luckily I work in the library, you know, I've got everything there.
Oh, those libraries.
I know. Aren't they amazing?
Fabulous.
Yeah. So I've got all the, you know, I read endless books. I found this amazing book that just is pictures of the seasons in Montana. It's like the most beautiful scenery, you know, and every page gets more beautiful than the last. And it's like, I became obsessed with it. But Montana, since I was a kid, we went to Disney. You know, my parents divorced when I was quite young, and I missed my dad a lot, missed seeing him, you know, missed having him there. Although I saw him often, you know, and he took me and my brother to Disney in America when I was a kid, and it was the best time of my life. So I look back on that memory, you know, and I was having a tough time. I remembered that version of me that was happy. I thought, I want to go back there. I want to be that person again. And we were in the queue at Disney World in a line to go on a ride, and we were talking to a family from Montana, and the man in front of us was, you know, they just painted this picture of this, you know, it sounded like paradise. And to me as well, growing up in London, it just seemed like this big open space.
Night and day.
And he said it was like switching from portrait to landscape, which made a line that made it into the book. And one of my friends went there and said the same line to me not that long ago, strangely, and it kind of jogged my memory. So that was Montana. I needed this place for Duchess to go to, you know, where she had no real choice but to look inward. She didn't have to care as much for her brother. There was someone to help her do that in her grandfather. She's kind of forced to spend some time there, and she develops this kind of friendship with one of the horses there. You know, it's not really a friendship, but it's like she's reluctantly caring for these animals, and she's quite abrasive, and I think it teaches her a lot, Montana. She starts to put down roots, and she's never done that before, because she's kind of a firm believer that anything good will be taken from her.
Right. And she's not used to that stability, and that Montana is it seems to help her with that. And there's a couple of sentences about the landscape. One of them is an early sentence in the book, and it says, "In Cape Haven, a shade beneath perfect might as well have been black."
Yeah. So I made Cape Haven this beautiful town. You know, I wanted it to be this picturesque, perfect town 30 years ago, because to walk, that's when he was happiest. You know, he had this brilliant childhood, and he knew he wanted to be a cop, and everything was falling into place. And then this terrible thing happened, and he kind of hit pause on his life, and he wanted the town to pause with him, and he wanted everything to hold off from moving on until Vincent came back again. And so he's never left the town. Very rarely even goes on vacation or anything like that. He just does all he can to keep this town from changing. So if someone's trying to build on a parcel of land, he will, you know, object to it. He will try and stop it happening. He wants, let's preserve. But it's also falling into the sea. Every now and then the ocean is eroding this cliff, and it will just claim one of the houses. And it very much mirrors Walk and what he's going through, and he's not very well, and he's kind of losing himself. And that's what I was going for in it.
And the so he, just as much as Duchess is looking for stability, so is Walk, right? He sees the big developers coming in. You've got this coastal erosion, climate change thing happening. The stores are changing, and he's just holding on, and he's trying to keep that together as much for himself as for anybody else, because it almost feels like the rug is being pulled out from underneath him.
Yeah. And it's hard to watch, I think, as a bystander, as a reader. It's hard to read sometimes because you know, nothing stays the same. He kind of knows it as well, but he's fighting it, and he's done it for such a long time. I think he doesn't know how to move forward or move on.
The other sentence again about this beautiful landscape that you write. Walk says at one point, Helena behind, the sky a canvas so big, not even God's work could distract him from the blues that afternoon.
Yeah.
So that's that rearview mirror scene. And oh my gosh, it was such a visual scene. And I'm thinking to myself, now that I know you were in the library, I wonder what page of that book you were looking at when you came up with that scene. Like, was it page 89? Here's the photo.
No, it's a collection of, so I work across three screens and I map out every scene with pictures and things like that, and I'm very visual before I write a single word, and it takes a while to set up each part of the book, and that's why it takes so long to write the book. But I need it, you know, I need you to feel like you can see what they're seeing. It's very important.
And it works, as we know, because you've got Disney and then you've got GMA and Barnes & Noble and Indie Next and Top Shelf. So I think everyone's sort of where...
When you say them all like that, it's mad, isn't it? Yes. I put them all together. I still think like, who are you talking about? You know, whose book is this? I want to read this one. But then, then I remember. Yeah, this is mine. Yeah, this is, it's just so, so strange.
And it I don't want the CWA dagger to feel jealous, but... When you start mounting all the other awards, it's going to feel a little sharp elbows there for the shelf space. Before I let you go, I just want to know, you're doing this book tour. Everything is happening so fast. If readers and listeners want to find you somewhere so they can see that interview with John Hart, which is just a terrific, terrific interview. It was 10 o'clock my time. It was god-awful early in the morning. Your time.
It was 3 a.m., yeah.
And I'm sitting there with my earbuds and trying to watch this video. Like, please don't fall asleep. Please don't fall asleep.
Well, I didn't know whether to sleep beforehand or not. I thought, because 3 o'clock is, you know, it's that weird time right between. You know, like 1 o'clock, I could stay up easily. 3 o'clock, do I go to sleep? What if the alarm doesn't go off and John Hart is left sitting there waiting for me? The fear of that stopped me.
And you're sleeping in REM sleep at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Someone has to shake you. Mrs. has to shake you. Honey, get up. John Hart. Oh my gosh. So where can readers find you, listeners, so that if they do want to follow along where you're going to be?
You can go on chriswhittaker.com. Which my lovely publishers made for me. It's just all of a sudden, that's another weird thing. All of a sudden, chriswhittaker.com exists. Or I'm on Twitter, which is, I keep my messages open so that people can direct message me because I love to hear from readers. And that my Twitter handle is Whitty, W-H-I-T-T-Y, because that was my nickname when I was growing up. Author, at Whitty Author.
I mean, yeah. Whitty Author, come on. That is like too perfect, Chris.
Yeah, because I get accused of it all the time because, oh, he must think he's funny. I'm sure
your brother says, no, he's really not.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I've just joined Instagram, but I still don't, you know, I'm not au fait with it. I don't know how it works properly. But I keep getting lovely messages on there, but I'm going to go into it at some point and, yeah, reply to everyone.
Yeah, people are really, shouting you out on Instagram. So, because your profile is there and it just says zero posts.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to post something. Maybe I should post the Disney thing or something like that. Yeah, I've got to get the hang of it.
Or just your face in front of like Times Square. I mean, that's... Yeah.
Yeah, that should be my new profile pic. Definitely.
Sorry, dagger. You know?
Yeah, it's just, it's hard, isn't it, to find the time? You know, Twitter is, there's just so many things to look at and so many messages and so many, just following the hashtag it takes some time. And then, you know, I've got to write a new book and I'm doing PR stuff and I'm still working at the library and I'm trading in the morning. And we've got a baby, 7-month-old.
Wait, you mean they're letting you trade?
They can't stop me.
Who is letting you trade?
Well, no, it's just me with my own money now. Okay. So I've been doing that for a while. So it's very small and it's just, yeah, it's very controlled. And I've been doing it for a long, long time now. Yeah, I have safeguards in place now to save me from myself.
Is Mrs. Whittaker the CEO of your trading company? Just so nothing nefarious happens.
Yeah, so that she takes the fall at some point.
When she brings you into the kitchen and all your children and your wife are sitting around the table, you know.
In the board meeting. Yeah. What have you been up to in your cabin at the end of the garden?
As you back away slowly, step by step.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I can't thank you enough for making this a stop here. I love that you keep mentioning that you work in the library. Do you still do that or is that something?
Still do that. Yeah, I was there. I'm working next Wednesday. I've managed to get a few days off because I'm really tired at the moment. But I use my days off from the library to do other like writing and things like that. So it's exhausting, but I really want to keep it up if I can.
May I ask what you do while you're there?
Oh, I do so much. So before, everything's changed, obviously, because of COVID. So we do click and collect now. So readers can select the type of book that they want and then we go and choose it, so everyone gets one of my books. if I'm selecting, they get a Christmas.
How could they not? I mean,
I know.
The Instagram posts start coming when they are like opening up their bag and they're holding up the book, because that, you know, that will happen. Chris Whittaker just handed me the book that I'm, you know, it's like a metaverse thing. I mean, I don't know what's happening.
And my best thing, the best thing that I do at the library is baby rhyme time, which is all the parents and the kids come in, the little babies, and I sit at the front with someone else from the library and we sing nursery rhymes and the kids try and climb on us and things like that. And I love that. That is my absolute favourite thing. Yeah, good fun.
I have no follow-up to that. No, just you coming home with sticky things in your hair.
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
It's like sticky things on your face, on your sweater. Yeah.
They are so sticky as well, the kids, you know, when they get you.
They will. They'll find
really
it.
Get you. Yeah.
They'll find the one sweater that you don't want to have a pull on, or I can't get the lollipop out of here. And it's just like it's stuck. And then you search the internet for how do you remove something sweet from your sweater? You know, and that's what you're reduced to.
Exactly right.
That sort of grounds you in many ways as you take on this next.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, because they don't care about Good Morning America. They're very self-involved, the children. They don't care about it. Actually, they might care about Disney, but not the side of Disney that I'll be working on.
That's right. And honestly, I will, full disclosure, I did watch the last episode of WandaVision very early this morning. And then I saw GMA on my screen. I'm like, what is happening right now? It's just insanity. Is there a book that you can recommend? Anything you want to share with readers that you've read personally that you love? I will certainly post the links for John Hart because
John Hart. So I read a book recently called The Last House on Needless Street, which I don't know when it comes out in the US. I think it's quite soon. But Stephen King quoted for that one. So, you know, it's a special one. Yeah. But I thought it was, it's a really special book. It's kind of a bit horror, but it's not really. And it's very unique and very well written and very clever. Yeah.
Okay. That will go right into my page for all of the listeners. Chris, I thank you so much for making Merrick Library's Top Shelf a stop on your book launch. This is incredible for you. I'm so happy for you and to everybody at Henry Holt who has helped this to get to where we are today. It's just amazing. Thank you so much.
I'm going to come and see you. I'm going to come to the library.
That
and I'm allowed.
Be careful. Yeah, we may give you the clip and you know.
I'd love it. Yeah, I would. Yeah, I'll do my rhyming.
Oh my gosh, that would be, nobody would know what to do with themselves. It would just be an insane day. Well, with that, listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been an incredibly fabulous ride for me. If you haven't already, go find that clip of Chris's face all over Times Square. It is not to be missed. I'm telling you, with a mouthful of toothpaste this morning, it was not a pretty sight on my end, but certainly on the TV, it looked fabulous. Remember to follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and wherever you find most podcasts for the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library. Check out our website at merricklibrary.com. www.merricklibrary.org. Special thanks to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Diane Bondi, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and onto the airwaves. No one would have ever expected that this podcast would have been this much fun. And until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.